Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program, a new book lifts the lid on power and profit, how Julius Malema turned political influence into personal wealth. A new report tracks South Africa's youngest earners, revealing how new professionals spend, save and struggle. Cape Town's plan to sell its convention center stake and Walmart's local expansion. Does it signal fresh momentum in commercial real estate? And which South African jobs are the most resilient and which may disappear in the next wave of automation? It's Wednesday. Now, few South African politicians have courted controversy or survived it, I guess, quite like Julius Malema. From tax battles and tender scandals to the VBS fallout, each storm, though, seems to leave him politically stronger, not weaker. Now, investigative journalist Apoli van Wyk, along with colleague Micah Reddy, have tracked Malema's career from its beginnings to his current role as one of the country's most high-profile, yet, I guess, polarizing power brokers. It's all in a new book called Malema, Money, Power, Patronage. Apoli, a very warm welcome. Let's start with the here and now. After this recent firearms conviction, do you think this marks the first real crack in Malema's political armor, or is it going to become another chapter, do you think, in his survival story?
Hello, Jeremy. Yes, I think you summed it up right. It's another, just going to be another survival mechanism for him. He already came out and said it would be an honor to kill, and he'll turn it into being a martyr. And there are very few politicians so adept at changing the argument than Julius is. He's a very talented politician in that way. So, for example, he would often argue investigative journalists are policing black wealth, or they do not want him to have nice things. And that's not the issue. It's not about what he has or what he buys with his money. It is about how he gets his money. And in the same way, he'll turn this conviction on his head and say that it's a justice system out to get him, as he's done many times before.
You talk about changing the argument or changing the narrative. I've got to ask you then, how much of his staying power over the years actually comes down to how the media frames him?
Yeah, that's an important question. And I do think that the media shares some blame in not, and we need to be very clear on that, not in covering him, but maybe not in covering him in the right way, where I think the media has been in the past, and the public as well, been very forgiving about his previous history of criminality. We remember how he reinvented himself in the Zuma years around 2016, where he just came from the On Point Limpopo corruption scandal, reinvented himself, organized the entire country behind him, rallied against Zuma, and in the end got the president out of his position. So, and very few people at the time, because Zuma was the common enemy, then remembered and reminded the country that this is the man who has his own corruption scandals in the back of in history.
Let's talk about the book itself. Was there a specific scandal, Poli, in your view, that was the real turning point in the survival story?
I think the overall story for me was just so exemplify how he is just this outliving, outlasting politician in all sorts of ways. So the On Point scandal way back in between 2005 and 2012 was his first real, very well documented sin, where he started making millions as a young COSAS and then a young ANC Youth League leader. And that was very clear that he was naive at the time, and over time he reinvented himself. But that On Point scandal, I think, may well come back to bite him.
And how complicated are his financial structures that have enabled him to find a degree of protection from the real scrutiny that you talk about?
It's fairly complicated, but not overly so that no one can follow it. The easiest way to start is at the man himself. Where does he get his wealth? He earns a salary from Parliament of around 1.27 million rand before tax. That would be 50,000 rand or so per month before or after tax. So when he owns a property portfolio that's worth at current value at around 40 million or more, we must know that something is wrong. And then you just go easily trace where does the money for his properties come from? Where does the money for his lifestyle come from? How does he pay school fees? How does he pay his living costs and fancy clothes? And when you trace that back, you'll very easily get to the slush funds and the funders behind Malema.
Polly, do you think the justice system has been independent enough in dealing with him?
No, definitely not. And I don't think that's a controversial opinion. I think it's the evidence is right before us. Because in the On Point story, there's at least 51 charges of corruption, fraud, racketeering, and money laundering against him. In the VBS scheme, there's potential charges of corruption and fraud and money laundering. In the metros, where he, with the help sometimes of then DA Mayor Herman Mashaba and other politicians, he fleeced some of the metros. There's again a case to be made of potential charges of corruption, fraud, and money laundering. And that's just three of the scandals that we very quickly summarize here. And I do think that the justice cluster is inundated. He's definitely not the only person that needs to be prosecuted and investigated, but he is one of the most influential. And if he is not prosecuted, then I do think other bad actors do get a kick out of it and realize that they can get away with the same.
And that is a critical point that you make, because I'm not sure if resilience is the right word, but let's use it anyway. It tells us something about the state of South Africa's body politic today, if that is allowed to happen, if those bad actors, as you call them, are allowed to get away with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And getting smarter. That's another sub-theme in this book. The book is, of course, about Malema, the man, but it's also about politics in South Africa. And to me, there's a very strong theme coming out if you look at, if you read the story, that if you leave someone for years with his crimes and you never prosecute him, you never investigate him, he's never held to account, they just get smarter. Their modus operandi are getting refined, and they're fleecing the state and the country of more money. Can you imagine what would have happened if he was just prosecuted and held to account for the On Point story? He would not, and the EFF would not be the ones being having the VBS scheme hanging as an albatross around their necks. You would not have fleeced the metros. You know, there's so much that would not have happened if the politicians in this country were held to account when they did the crime.
And just a quick answer in conclusion, the book's been out for a couple of weeks now. What response have you had to it, particularly from Malema at all, or those around him?
Malema's trying to ignore it and hope that the noise is going away.
And that's where we're going to leave it. Co-author of the book Malema, Money, Power, Patronage, Polly van Wyk, thank you very much indeed. Her co-author is Micah Reddy.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, there's a new report from the UCT Liberty Institute of Strategic Marketing in partnership with Liberty, and it offers a fascinating snapshot of how young South Africans are managing money after entering the workplace. The report is called the First 100 Paychecks Report, and it tracks around 700 professionals from their first job to their 100th salary, revealing how higher education changes lives, how the gender pay gap persists, and how much spending power this group actually wields. It's something in the region of R1 trillion a year among graduates aged between 30 and 39. It is fascinating stuff. Well, joining us now is Zandile Makhoba, who is Liberty's lead research and insight specialist. Zandile, a very warm welcome. So how does the typical path then from first job to financial confidence look for young professionals today? Is that a tough road?
It is definitely a tough road, Jeremy, especially if you think about how difficult it is to become a graduate in South Africa. So if we just look at the schooling statistics, for every 100th grade one students who go into school, only 12% of those, so 12 students, will eventually become tertiary students, and only 4% or 4 individuals would then become graduates. And after that very difficult journey, which is, you know, financial challenges, educational challenges, all of that having overcome, you then are also dealing with the changes in the economy that have made it a little bit more difficult for our economy to absorb even the skills that we are already short of. So our graduate unemployment has increased over the years from 6% in 2008 to now 12% in 2023. And that is creating a lot of new level that graduates need to deal with in order to become established adults.
What it also tells me, if you look at that cohort 30 to 39, the psychological makeup is interesting because it talks to absolute fortitude, commitment, and real resilience, doesn't it?
Definitely. So we are seeing now this emergence of a period of transition, really, that allows people to go from graduate to working adult. There's a big realization, you know. I think we've all heard this term adulting. Adulting is now a verb, you know. Mm. It's an active process of coming to terms with what it means to be grown up, facing the cost of living crisis, realizing that the world of work is changing and you have to constantly upgrade your own self and your own skills to be able to manage that. And really also non-financial things like partnering up, finding the right person to do life with so that it actually does ease some of the non-financial elements as well.
Zandile, let me pick you up on that word upgrading. What this report also tells me is the huge difference that a university qualification makes in building long-term financial security.
Absolutely. So once the hurdle has been overcome, we do know that in South Africa, an education is definitely the best chance of employment. We know the broader stats is that we've got between 35% to 40% unemployment in SA. So a graduate unemployment rate of 12 is very much lower. But also it does mean that graduates do get a little bit of a premium in terms of earnings in South Africa because we do have the challenge with the skills. What we're also seeing is that with the more integrated global environment, greater access to technology and internet connection, graduates are more able to take on opportunities that exist in the global set. So whether it be working remotely for multinationals within the South African context or looking at opportunities to move abroad, these are things that have become very real for our grads.
I'm pleased you used the word hurdle because if you're female, those hurdles just don't go away, do they? The report highlights, and one shouldn't be surprised about this, a persistent gender pay gap. I'm assuming it's wide and I'm assuming it's not really closing.
It is a systematic element of where our economy comes from, Jeremy, and we are seeing that despite the higher numbers of female graduates, the pay differentiation is still very strong. But what we're also looking at is how, you know, the slow employment growth in SA is a big challenge in terms of entrepreneurial activity and creating new job opportunities through SME startups and so on. Graduates are more likely to produce startups and successful startups at that. In fact, 70% of self-employed people are graduates. And the outlook there is that we may see a future where more startups and more businesses are female owned, creating better opportunities in the future for female grads.
And Zandile, let's come back to the paychecks now. What does the research say about common early mistakes that people make with their money?
What is quite surprising, Jeremy, is that our youth are becoming much more financially savvy. So historically, their parents might have made a lot of mistakes around excessive credit take-up and so on. What we are seeing now is that there is more deliberate consideration around how one takes up and uses that credit. We're also seeing that a lot of the purchasing behavior in this intermediary years is very much about investing in their potential to earn better in future. So whether it be taking up a short course or buying a wardrobe that allows you to be more professional in the workplace, those are some of the smart things that young people are doing with their early paychecks. So it's not a road that is not without challenges, but there's smartness happening there.
Providing, of course, you don't have an onerous student loan or high personal debt.
Absolutely. But what we did see with the sample of graduates in the collection is that 85% of them started their careers without any student debt. It is also a function of the financial background of graduates. You know, getting into university does depend a lot on the financial background that you come from. And we are seeing that just the entry into university is biased towards middle class and upper income households. It then does create a big bearing for parents, you know, as they think about their children's futures. How best can you create a path for them that will be as smooth as possible?
The report is called the First 100 Paychecks Report. I've been in conversation with Zandile Makoba, who is Liberty's lead research and insights specialist.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, I see that South Africa's commercial property market is starting to show real signs of life. Two headline developments. You would have read that the city of Cape Town is planning to sell its majority stake in the convention center, and Walmart's decision to launch its own branded stores locally. Is that a signal of renewed investor confidence and fresh momentum across the sector? Well, Galetti Corporate Real Estate Chief Executive Officer John Jack says these moves reflect a shift towards smarter public-private partnerships and a stronger global appetite for South African assets. John, a very warm welcome to you. Let's start with the Cape Town International Convention Centre. Fair to say it's delivered hundreds of millions, if not billions, in GDP value. It's created many, many jobs. Why sell an asset that is clearly performing well?
I think, you know, if the city looks at what it's trying to achieve, and that would be upliftment of the people in its domain, it would be trying to achieve and trying to change some of the social norms and people living in poor conditions. That's where they should be spending their money. Are they an investment manager? No. And what happened here is that they had the site, they built the property, they got the highest and best use, and yes, it's delivered massive value. But effectively now they're sitting in the position of we're investors, where they should be sitting in the position of let's use the money that we have to try and change people's lives. And that's what they want to do. They want to upgrade services and they want to improve what the Western Cape is.
Do you think the sale is a once-off then, or maybe part of a new, bigger trend towards cities, not just Cape Town, possibly monetizing their property portfolios?
Yes, I think so. And Western Cape has really sort of spearheaded this. So if you looked at the old Virgin Active along Somerset Road, what they did is they went into a lease auction for that site, and where Virgin Active were paying a number. When they took it to auction, they found that there were a number of bidders. And this has happened on other sites as well. Take the Galley on Fishhook Beach and various other sites around Cape Town, where they've actually gone and found out what is the market willing to pay for these sites. And they found that they got a multiple on what they were receiving in rental. So what they're really trying to do with these sites, especially the ones that they can't sell, for example, is really try and achieve maximum value on that, a commercial value, and at the same time assets which are sitting that they don't need to own, that they will reprioritize the funds.
But the challenge, of course, is to ensure that any new kind of private ownership of a public asset still serves the broader public interest. How do you guarantee that?
They do maintain board seats of the CTICC, or that's the first thing that they're doing. But then I suppose at the same time, you're going to adjudicate your buyer. And one number to look at is your selling price. They have a value that they've proposed here of the sale of their shareholding at 884 million, or 885 million, less 2 rand. And they look at that number and they said that is one of the numbers in determining who they will sell it to. Another one is, who are the people who are going to run this thing? And of course, the other shareholders here are Sun and the Western Cape government. So it's not only them who are the shareholders. That is just the, you know, province sits with a 22% shareholding, and SunWest sits with another 5% odd shareholding. So there is, province is still involved here. It's not completely sold. It's just they're selling out of the city shareholding, as it were, in the Cape Town International Convention Center Limited entity. Yeah.
John, let me turn to Walmart. What do you think its direct brand entry into this country say about confidence in the retail property market? This is something to be welcomed, I imagine.
I'd say so. You've looked at a couple of big property deals. You looked at Hyde Park selling 50% recently, and the general move in retail where it's become a darling asset once again. And it's been performing. You know, the South African retailers have been performing. And really, where you get international brands, and let's not forget that Walmart is involved with Massmart, and they acquired all the shareholding there. So they're already in South Africa. They're seeing firsthand the numbers that are happening. So what is happening here is they're only bringing their own, that Walmart brand, as it were, is what they're bringing into the country. And there you're competing against some of the existing brands, actually. So you might see a change in the brand name. From a game to a Walmart, for example, and at the same time, some other retailers that compete in that space.
But in the world that you work in, it's all about location, I imagine. Is this Walmart model going to revive flagging retail nodes, of which there are many, or is there a danger, a risk that it consolidates power in larger scale developments?
So I would say that if you consider the type of Walmart developments, big box retail really. So, you know, these flagging developments are often sort of centers, multi-tenanted centers. That's not really the type of occupancy that we understand Walmart as. Walmart is really the big box. So if you were to imagine a macro, that's the type of occupancy. So they are typically destination stores. So they would either be looking at existing sites where they could convert a brand, or alternatively, they'd be looking for new sites, which is great news for the developers. But I think in terms of consolidation of brand and where people are shopping, sure, it's a very powerful brand. I'm assuming they're going to take some of the market share there. And, you know, I don't feel like there's Leroy Merlin would be a big competition to them, but it covers other spaces as well. It's really that macro brand, which is Massmart held.
Mm. What about risk, though, John? Developers and investors are obviously optimistic at the moment. We've also had 5 rate cuts this year, but we also have the persistent challenges of weak municipalities. There's political risk, there's water risk, and in many cases, power risk.
Sure. I mean, there's going to be, obviously, as we know, there's a lot happening with the mayoral race in Johannesburg. What that actually means, there seems to be some confidence based on the new approach by Helen Zille to run the mayoral committee. She become the mayor of Johannesburg. And so there is some confidence there, and we are seeing some investment following that. So early investment into the market, or into the Johannesburg market, at least, ahead of perhaps that decision, even though it's not a fait accompli that she becomes the mayor. But it is certainly, even if she doesn't become the mayor, what the existing mayoral candidate and committee will have to really upgrade what they're delivering. Because they know that if they're not delivering at the highest level, it's going to then fall to another party. And so I think either way, it's a win-win scenario for Johannesburg. And so, you know, Johannesburg investors are saying, okay, well, it's not all that bad here. And of course, we've seen some of the other news reports and Lightstone reporting that there is a trend of people moving back to Johannesburg from some of the coastal regions. So, yeah, there is concern, obviously, with the decline of the municipalities in Johannesburg. But I think it can only be set to improve.
So just a quick one in conclusion, given your optimism, which subsectors of commercial real estate are now the real growth plays?
Interesting. So I think, you know, those certainly those community centers, retail centers, because once you upgrade infrastructure and that type of thing, you certainly get people wanting to get out there and be in those centers. And I saw some brilliant statistics yesterday of actually tracking where they track the cell phone movements of people moving around the city. But another one, of course, is logistics, because logistics heavily relies on your roads and your infrastructure and your rail, etc. And recently we've obviously seen that Transnet is opening up their rail network to third-party providers, so private providers who will be on the rail network. That is a huge plus for logistics. Secondly, we've seen this port of Gauteng, which is just south of the Wadeville type corridor, which will be another huge logistics improvement. So I would say your industrial and logistics corridors. And then once that starts happening, the whole economy starts to run slightly better. And then retail is the beneficiary of that. So I would say those are the two immediate that I would look at.
John Jack, thank you very much indeed. He is the Chief Executive Officer of Galletti Corporate Real Estate.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, South Africa's job market is showing fresh signs of strain. According to jobs portal PNET's latest job market trends report, overall hiring activity in August has dropped 3% year on year, with candidate database searches taking the sharpest knock. Yet some sectors, like design, media and arts and marketing, are still showing some strength. Well, let's get behind the numbers. I'm in conversation with Paul Byrne. He's been on the program with us before, head of data insights at PNET. So, Paul, welcome. A 3% drop in hiring activity doesn't sound huge, but is this the start maybe of a deeper slowdown in the job market? Is this early warning intelligence and a red flag?
I think that what we're seeing is that there's been extreme volatility through the hiring market through the entire year, in actual fact. And again, looking at the data, when you see specifically at the trends that we've got in vacancy advertising, it's been up 1 month, down another month. And I think there have been so many headwinds at play during the course of the last 12 months and actually further back than that, that it really just has kind of slowed business certainty in terms of what we should be doing about increasing our workforces to really start accelerating the growth that we would want to see and expect to see within our economy, hopefully in the not too distant future. So yeah, really, my message has been that it's been a volatile year.
Candidate database searches plunging 14% year on year. Explain that to me, and what is driving the sharp decline within that percentage?
Jeremy, the way that we work across a jobs platform like PNET is that we've got the combination of the opportunity for a recruiter to post their vacancies, and then simultaneously they can get into our database and actually start searching for very specific skills. And the beauty of that is that they can really hone in and identify the type of skill that they want to communicate with very, very quickly. And I think it's just going down to so that volume of markets and listings within the market, and that opportunity for the placement of people. So that got us really thinking about what in actual fact we need to be looking at and seeing why this decline is happening. Is it across certain industries? And very specifically, and more importantly, where are we seeing the growth coming in terms of the opportunities that we've now defined in this latest report of ours as the, we've called them the future proof opportunities, where we've seen significant growth across different industries over the last 3 years. And I think that in actual fact is starting to show a significant change in our way of work.
Paul,
really look at that data.
I must confess, I'm a little surprised that, and I mentioned this in the introduction, design, media and arts vacancies up, did I read this figure correctly, 65% year on year. How can that be?
I think what we're seeing is that there's a lot more focus on branding, especially as we're getting out into more and more of the e-commerce world. Companies are really starting to put an effort into how they market their products when they can't, when there's something less tangible. So when it comes to design, media and arts, that is going to be a key skill of the future. And certainly that ability to market, whether it is products, whether it's services, whatever the case may be, it's going to continue to grow. And indeed, what we have have seen is, as you correctly say, is that just consistent growth. And month in and month out over the last few years, last few months, we've been talking about this ongoing growth within that. And I think within the marketing sector too, that's the other one that we've highlighted here with 19% growth year on year in marketing. And there's actually, I think, quite an important message in that. As much as we've seen this volatility in the job market that I was talking about now, you know, if you really think when budgets become tight within organizations, the first budgets that are cut are the marketing budgets and the design, media, and art budgets. So for me, this is a positive sign. It's too early to call what an actual fact is going to have, what kind of impact it's going to have on the jobs market. But actually seeing this increase in the types of roles that have been advertised, the marketing roles and the design, media, and arts roles, does suggest that there is a little bit more cash available within companies to start spending on what matters, which is that marketing and building their companies. And ultimately, what we would expect to see is then sales roles starting to go up, and then everything else will then follow, hopefully, if my predictions are anywhere close to an improved hiring economy as we move into next year and actually get past some of these headwinds that I've been talking about. You know, let's not forget with all the tariffs AGOA and the renegotiation, the uncertainty about what's actually happening there, that is definitely going to have an impact on many businesses here in South Africa in terms of just saying, well, let's wait and see what happens. But those indicators in terms of design, media, and arts and marketing are suggesting that they're preparing to start hopefully accelerating business opportunity.
Paul, a kind of a hardy evergreen, I guess, would be admin and support roles, still rising year on year. But you might have drawn some conclusion, I imagine, about the balance between white collar and digital first skills as a result of that finding.
We certainly do. There's no doubt about it. We are starting to see that digital fluency is becoming more and more important in the workplace. Yes, certainly with everything that we've heard in the media and we read about in terms of the impact of AI on all of our jobs, it's something that we need to start taking very, very seriously. And in actual fact, in a report that we did last month, we were talking about the impact of AI on South African jobs and just, again, the growth and the demand for an AI skill set, which we, in that particular report, sort of split into AI jobs. So in other words, the people that are needing to build the AI systems that we're going to be using. But then we also looked at the demand for AI skills. In other words, for everyone else who needs to start adapting to the use of AI in the actual day-to-day jobs to improve efficiency and effectiveness and in some cases professionalism. And what that data was showing us is that just this year alone, there's been a 77% increase in the demand for that type of skill. So definitely suggesting that shift within that admin space, more of the mundane type job, work that a person might do, the sort of recurring, sort of regular tasks that they might have, those are going to be replaced, as we know, by AI. And we're definitely seeing that shift in companies saying, we need to start thinking about this into our future now.
So just a final one then on artificial intelligence. Is that now becoming more critical to aid the growth of South Africa's economy, or are there other skills which are just as critical, but we're maybe just caught up in the hype of AI?
We are definitely caught up in the hype of AI. Every time we turn on a media channel or read something, there's talking about the impact of AI on our daily lives. And I think it's so ingrained in so much of what we do. In some cases, we don't even realize it. AI is in Netflix, for example. It's in the way that we engage with Uber. So it's definitely part and parcel of what it is that we are living in, sort of the daily lives right now. But yes, it is becoming really, really important that we all understand it. But I think I underpin your question by saying, it really speaks to the need for us to all be digitally literate. We need to make sure that in order to be able to adapt to the skills of this future world of work that I talk about, there needs to be this baseline of digital fluency. And we've got to get everyone up to that particular point, because nowadays what's going to happen again, even, you know, let's take an example of software developers, there is a bottom rung of the ladder that's going to be replaced by AI coming into our workplace, where these tools and these engines can actually start to do the work that a junior developer would have needed to understand how to do. And in so doing, what it does create is the opportunity for that junior developer to come in at a different level. But they have to have that underlying skill in terms of understanding the fluency and what it is that they need to know within this digital space. But, you know, very interestingly, and just in one sort of last point quickly, is that what we've seen in this report also is that as much as there is all this hype about AI, there are industries where we can see that there's still significant growth. And you know, AI aside and the IT sector aside, what we're definitely seeing is that within business management, there is a very definite need in terms of future skills and digital transformation specialists. We've seen in particular over the last 3 years have grown 180% in demand. I suppose there's no surprise there because those are the people that help organizations digitize, which is so important today. But your automation managers also are growing incredibly quickly at 73% over the last 3 years. But then just to mention a couple of other industries, transportation, warehousing, and logistics, we've seen some significant growth across the supply chains, logistic coordinators, transportation engineers, and even in manufacturing, which is a good sign again for me. We're seeing it come up in terms of manufacturing technicians, manufacturing engineers, robotics technicians, all showing some positive growth. And those are the types of jobs that I think are going to be important. And then that's going to take us across other industries as well. And we'll get into green energy, more care skills within care needed, education, and even frontline roles.
If I told my late 92-year-old father that I was going to be a digital transformation specialist, Paul Byrne, head of data insights at PNET, he would have shaken his head. Thank you very much for talking to me. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.